This is Megan Bucknam with Louisa Bergos Villet on July 3rd, 2017 at Solaris in Hudson, New York. This interview is part of the Oral History Summer School's archive about the stories of Hudson, New York. Louisa, would you quickly introduce yourself?
Sure. This is Louisa Bergos Villet, and I live in Hudson.
And this is the third audio file due to some technical issues. Louisa, before the latest technical issue, we were discussing some of the trainings that you were doing at the first Community Action Committee that you mm-hmm. worked at. And I want to hear more about that, but I also want to pause and ask where that CAC or Community Action Committee was.
As Community Action Agency?
Community
that
Action
That one was
Agency.
In Schoharie County.
In
and
Schoharie
that's about, are you familiar with New York? Do you live in New York?
Nope.
Oh, okay. So that's about an hour and a half west of here.
Okay.
Yeah. So that I lived and worked in a town called Cobleskill. So
okay.
It was a interesting area for me to be in, and once I was done, I was so done, I needed to get out of there. It was very different. It was culture shock, first moving there, and I moved out of New York City, and I moved out of a very strong Latino community that I loved, but my husband at the time and I decided that we didn't like the things that were happening in the city schools, and my son loved it. My parents had a place up there, and my son loved going up there, my oldest son at the time. And I was pregnant with my second son, and we just decided it was time to make that move. So I still don't know whether that was a good move or not, but it's what we did. And almost 4 years ago, I left there. Everybody else had flown the coop. My husband and I broke up many years ago, and my sons were all grown and gone. And so it was after my youngest son was old enough to go out on his own that I said, all right, now I'm done with this. I'm ready to go. So I don't know if it was the best place to raise my sons. You know, I guess there's pros and cons everywhere. My sons are men of color who did not always have an easy time there. There was a lot of prejudice there as well. But we also had a lot of support from people who I knew and people who, you know, loved us. So, yeah. If I had it to do different, I wouldn't have moved there. So I know a lot of people feel like, you know, if they had stuff to do over, they would still do exactly what they did. But, yeah, that's one thing that I think I would have never moved there. But who knows? I did move there, so. Was that outside the room?
There was just a little beep in the room.
Yeah, okay.
In terms of Cobleskill and you and your family
mm-hmm.
having some support there,
mm-hmm.
how did you find that support?
I met people in a lot of different ways. Some of it was through, my sons were all really active in sports. So some of it was meeting other parents and so on. But I also met a lot of people through the work that I did. And there were things that I was interested in the community. There was this health food store that was there that was kind of like a community gathering place. It had a little cafe. And it's not there anymore, and it actually didn't last that long. But I met people there, so yeah, I met people in different ways. And then there was a group that I helped form, actually, that was other parents, mostly Black and Latino, who we were having a lot of problems in the school, which with not just things that are kids were dealing with, but with the lack of response and lack of even know how to respond that the school district had, they were awful. And it was much easier for them to ignore things than to deal with them because I think that was a lot of it. They didn't know what to do, so they just didn't do things. But my sons had some issues in the school that were really bad to me. They were being attacked and called names and stuff like that. So there were other parents that we got together and we started this organization that was at first it was to it was called ACCORD, a community committee on respect and diversity. And we initially formed because we wanted the school to respond to our concerns. There were times when we were feeling like our kids weren't safe in school. They were being called names and the teachers weren't doing anything about it. And then they were being like, kids start doing things like they do in cafeterias where they'd come up behind, especially my middle son, and, push him or throw stuff at him. And so anyway, and then other people were having similar situations with their kids. So we started this organization, which we didn't think of it as an organization at first. It was just parents getting together saying, this has to change. And at first, the school was not responsive and looked at us as a bunch of troublemakers. But little by little, we had some wonderful people who were a part of this group. And little by little, by the time I left there, that was looked at as a wonderful resource for the community in the school district. So that was interesting to watch that change over the years. So I met people through that. Then as my two older sons left and went out on their own, and it was just my younger son, I had broken up with my husband, then I had more free time, like in the evenings and stuff, and I got involved in all kinds of things in the community, so I knew a lot of people through that. I did stuff with the... There was a community theater group that I was a part of when they first formed, because there was a state university there, and I knew this guy who was an English professor, and he was a part of the... He was also a theater critic for the local, not the local, but the closest cities that had theater as a big thing. So he was really involved in the theater. So they wanted to start a community theater there. And it was just happened to be some of the people I knew, and they kind of drew me into that. So I did that for a lot of years while I was there. I performed and I helped produce and direct shows and stuff like that. And it was just, I don't know, little by little, getting to know people. Although I will say so I had a big group of people that I was friends with when I left that community, and almost all of them were not from there. They were all from somewhere else. It's a beautiful area. It's gorgeous. Outside of Cobleskill is the biggest town. I don't know whether they're considered a small city or a town, but they're the biggest community in that county. And the surrounding area used to be all dairy farms, like family dairy farms. But, that whole industry has changed a lot in this country. There are, all over the country, family farms have been put out of business, and there's big corporate farming. I don't think there's a lot of corporate farming there, but a lot of the small family farms or smaller family farms, especially dairy farms, they're just put out of business because of the way that business is run in this country. So the area around there had changed a lot gradually over years. And after 9/11, because real estate was much cheaper up there than the city, it was probably like 3 hours into New York City there. And a lot of people were looking after 9/11 to get out of the city. That was such a big thing. It was such a shift in the state's, personality, I guess, because so many people wanted to leave the city after that. So people came up and bought property up there, and it changed, not entirely, but it changed the community in a lot of ways, which to me were all good ways. It brought, it kind of woke up the community. There were some very interesting people there. And it never went so far as to raise prices a lot and stuff. Like in this city, in Hudson, gentrification is a huge issue. And that didn't really happen there. But It's interesting to me to see how communities change over time. And Hudson is a real study in that. Mm. It's changed a lot. Just in the time that I've been here, and I've only been here, you know, a little less than 4 years, but in talking to people and some of the organizations I'm involved in here that deal with that kind of stuff, it's changed a lot in people's ability to be able to survive here. You know, there's families. And if you look, if you've done any walking around Hudson, there's Warren Street, which is all incredibly overpriced antique show stores and you know, a lot of nice coffee shops and restaurants and galleries and so on. And there's a lot of money that's being poured into Warren Street, not from this local community for the most part, but from people from somewhere else with a lot of money. Mostly, I mean, I think this is at least what it looks like, is a lot of people from New York City who have second homes up here. And, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't have to be a negative for a community. And actually, there are a lot of resources that are put into the community because of it. However, the people, a lot of people who have lived here their whole lives are not participating in that. You know, it's not like it extends to them, the increase in resources and so on. So you go a block over from Warren Street, which is where I lived. I live in subsidized housing that's just like two blocks down that way and a block over, and it's a totally different neighborhood. But it is slowly becoming really unaffordable for a lot of people, because as those resources come in, the prices go up. So that means the rent prices, the prices to buy a house. So what I can see coming down, you go block over from Warren, and then there's Columbia and State, and those two streets that run parallel to Warren as they go up were all not such great housing. You know, a lot of it was kind of a lot of landlords who didn't take care of it. I don't know what the percentage of home ownership is there, but, you know, probably a lot lower than a block that way, you know, it's a much different kind of neighborhood. But slowly, properties are being bought up there and being renovated, so that's good. But it's not like they're affordable for people who have lived here for a long time. So it's that whole process that's happening, I think, in every community up the Hudson River. Because down the river, by car, like 45 minutes, is a small city, Kingston, which is bigger than Hudson. There's a lot more in Kingston. And it's on the other side of the river. And that's where my youngest son, my sister and her wife live. And it's happening there as well. But Kingston is a bigger city, and there's a lot more. So it's almost like they can absorb that a little bit more. But the prices are still, and ultimately that's what happens, is the prices go up so much that people can no longer afford to live where they've always lived. And if there's not a conscious effort on the part of the people coming into the community to do something with that and to really, you know, come into a community and really be a part of that community, it creates some really bad situations and bad feelings, and, you know, that has definitely happened here. Mm. So I don't know way around it. You know, there are different communities that have done it, have handled it in a lot of different ways. Like that, where I consider my hometown to be East Harlem and Manhattan. That neighborhood is completely changed now. And a lot of the people that I know, unless they were in some kind of protected housing, you know, there's rent stabilization where some people's rent can only go, which goes back to like the 60s and 70s, I think, where your rent can't be raised over time over a certain percentage. So it's mostly people who are in those kind of protected situations that can still afford to live there. A lot of people can't. And my old friends could never live there now. They can't afford it because other people with a lot of money decided that, oh, this neighborhood is someplace we want to be now. They never wanted to be there before. But, you know, so it's an interesting thing that's happening, I think, all over the country, but particularly in the New York area and along the Hudson, because if people can easily get from wherever you are to New York City, then that's the draw. So anyway, that's like political stuff. I don't want to get way off on that.
You mentioned that your home, East Harlem, has changed a lot. In what ways is it different?
Well, when I was first there, which was back in the late 60s, early 70s, that's when I first stayed there. It was a low-income community for sure, for most of it. It was a very strong, it was a Latino community, so there was a lot of bodegas. There was a lot of things that were in Spanish. You felt the personality of that neighborhood as soon as you walked into it. But it wasn't necessarily where a lot of resources were spread around from the city. So there were things that weren't there. It was like this neighborhood down here, this is what's called a food desert. There, if you've been here for a few days and try to go to a grocery store, you'll see there's none down here. There's one up, about a block up or two blocks up that has the most outrageous prices. It's ridiculous. So it's not a place where people can go and do grocery shopping. So that's one of the things that happens is if there's no resources put into a community, there's certain kind of businesses that won't go there either. Like there's plenty of alcohol, there's plenty of liquor stores and stuff in neighborhoods like that. And there's smaller bodegas in communities, which is like a small grocery store, a corner store. And that's what people wind up using as a grocery store, which is always, you're always going to pay more and it's never going to have what you really, the full amount. So it's one of the things you see in neighborhoods like that. The resources just aren't there. The schools are not maintained. There's not a lot of resources put into the school. There's not a lot of resources put into the buildings or into housing. Nobody cares if the landlords don't keep up the buildings. There's just not a lot of attention paid. And once, but East Harlem in the city is in a prime location. And once people started realizing that and decided we can get cheap real estate here, money started coming in, but it wasn't money that was going to benefit the neighborhood, not completely. And so people started buying up buildings, houses, renovating them, and the people who were already there just couldn't afford to live there anymore. So there's some protected housing there, but for the most part, the neighborhood is changing in that way. And then also, what happens is businesses, like, family businesses that have been there maybe for generations, can no longer afford to be there either. Because a lot of times they didn't own the building that they were in, so they paid rent, and the rent becomes too high for them to be able to survive. So there's a lot of things that happen, but basically what happens is the community that made it such a community are pushed out and it totally changes it. So there's there's a lot of people who are still there and I think you still feel the flavor of the neighborhood, but it's nothing like it used to be. Even though, there was a lot of stuff, especially through the 70s, that weren't so great in the early 80s. There was a lot of, that's when heroin was a huge problem on the streets, but the first job I ever had actually was working in a rehab program there that we started in the neighborhood. But that wasn't such a big deal for the rest of the world because it was Latinos and people of color who were in these ghettos and what do you expect? Now that it's gone out into suburbia and now that addiction is such a problem in so many other places, it's moved out of poor neighborhoods and now it's affecting families who do have a lot of resources. Now it's a national issue. So there's a lot of things that like that make it so obvious where the resources flow is where there's going to be services and where people are going to be able to survive in the best kind of way. So that neighborhood was actually, Time Magazine did a piece on, and I don't remember because it was back in the like late 70s. I was amazed that they even came there. But they did a piece on, I don't know whether they were doing a bunch of neighborhoods, but they did a piece on East Harlem. And I used to have a copy of it. I don't know if I have it anymore. And some of the people that they talked to were teenagers in the neighborhood. And this one young woman who was probably like 16, I don't remember the questions that they asked her. I think they asked her some question about, how do you think, you know, the rest of the world or the rest of the city views like your neighborhood and you guys? She said, they don't. We're invisible. Nobody wants to see us here. So it's not even like they look down on us. They just don't see us. We're invisible. Nobody wants to know we're here. The services, they actually, do you know what redlining is? Oh, you've had,
yeah,
what's
but
her
could
name
you,
doing that?
Would you mind telling me what
well,
it means
in
to you?
The way, so I don't want to get too much into this because that's a whole like lecture. But anyway, the way the transportation systems were designed in New York City was a very intentional way of isolating certain communities, and East Harlem's one of them. So even the way you'd have to look at it, I don't remember the details of this because when I first learned about it was a long time ago. But if you look kind of like overhead at the different subway lines and bus lines and all that kind of stuff, there's especially from back a long time ago, there's certain neighborhoods that were completely isolated as far as transportation. So it wasn't easy, like if somebody needed to go to work, getting in and out of there. And those were poor neighborhoods where people of color lived. So it wasn't something that just happened. It was very intentional, like redlining, where there were certain communities. And do you know what a sundown community is?
Mm-mm.
There are certain communities across the country. People think of this as only happening in the South, but it didn't only happen in the South. Certain communities that were called sundown communities, and some of them had that posted right on the name of the town. A sundown community is where a person of color has to get out of there if they're there for some reason by sundown, or they could be killed or lynched or any, you know, something horrible would happen to them. And that was known and accepted. The same way segregation. I mean, you think about those things that seem outlandish and like, how could that ever have been something that was accepted? But it was. And there are clearly, as you can see in the news and surrounding us, there's a lot of people who still think like that. But that, especially that girl, really, I remember being so struck like that. So this is a young woman who's one among all the kids who were growing up in that community who had a very clear view of how the rest of the world looked at them. And imagine what that does to someone as they're growing up to really understand that. And she wasn't wrong.
Mm-hmm.
She was right. These systems, a lot of them in this country, were built to do certain things and to support certain communities and to not support other communities. So it's not like the systems aren't working right. They're working exactly the way they were designed to. They were just totally full of inequity from the beginning. So anyway, I don't know where that's going to take us as a country, but I think things are going to get a lot worse before they get better.
I'm curious about that, the little girl's quote in Time magazine, and what some of the community conversations in East Harlem were like after that article came out.
I don't really remember that. I just remember particularly hers. I mean, my memory's not so great anyway. I know when I don't remember stuff, but I remember her. I didn't know her personally, but they put her on the cover of the magazine. I always wondered what happened to her.
Mm.
I mean, even in the way she expressed herself, she was very bright. But I don't think she was unique. You know, I think a lot of kids growing up in neighborhoods like that, they totally get it. They understand. They see the world around them. Mm. So anyway, it was just something that really struck me. But I don't remember a lot of conversation. It wasn't new news to the people who lived there. They all lived it. They knew it. The only people who didn't get it were people who didn't live there. You know, people who would look at it and go, oh, wow, that really? that wasn't new to the people in the neighborhood. They knew it. They lived it too.
Mm-hmm. What do you think a child living in Hudson might say about this community?
Same thing.
Same thing.
Well, I know they would. A lot of them. Let me say that. Because up until recently, I was on the board of the social justice organization here in Hudson. And they run, together with other incredible partners in this community, run a summer leadership academy, social justice leadership academy. And there were, I actually don't remember how this conversation came about, but there was a conversation with some of the teenage girls in this community, probably about the same age as she was. And they talked about how they felt walking up Warren Street. Like, these are kids who grew up a block, two blocks over, and said they don't feel welcome here. This is their city, it's their community. They don't feel welcome here. And a couple of girls were talking about walking up Warren Street, and they could see, like, it's white women who were walking towards them, who as soon as they saw them, they would like hold their pocketbook, you know, like more. They would, I mean, you know these things. When you're a kid of color, this is your life. This is it, you know it, you feel it. And sometimes it's hard when other people go, oh, you're just imagining that. No, that's bullshit. They're not imagining. They know exactly what that means. And they talked about feeling unwelcome in some of the stores on Warren Street. I don't remember how this conversation came about, and it wasn't like a formal, they weren't being interviewed or anything. It was just a conversation. But they talked about not feeling welcome at all in the stores along this stretch, Warren Street, and feeling like they couldn't go in places. So we were trying to make the point, like, yes, you can. This is your home. Their reaction is their problem. But that's not the way it feels, you know. Plus, especially now, more than for a long time, people feel perfectly safe in expressing horrible prejudices and expressing them in really violent ways that, you know, people, they're right feeling like they might not be safe in certain places. I mean, I felt this with my son. Any mother of kids of color who their kids have to go out in this country, in this world every day, know that they're a target in a way that other kids are not. And that's just the reality. You know, I saw it. Every one of my sons has dealt with it. And it doesn't change when they get older. My oldest son has worked his ass off his whole life. He's a personal trainer, and he owns his own business. He lives on the West Coast. He'll never come back here. Him and my middle son, they both live on the West Coast. So he has his own business. He has a gym in California. And him and his girlfriend have been together for years. They've done really well. She works in a bank or something. They've done really well. And it's been important to them. But it didn't protect him when a couple of years ago, he came home. He lives in a beautiful neighborhood, in a beautiful house. And he came home one night, and actually it was the day he signed the lease on the gym. And he's been working towards this whole life. He started working out when he was 14. And he came home. He pulled up in his driveway, and two cop cars pulled up. They blocked his car, and the other one drove up on his freaking lawn, and they got out, guns drawn, and told him to get out of the car and go face down on the lawn. And he said the thing that scared him the most is that he could see the one guy, his hand was shaking, he's holding the gun, pointing it at him. And they wouldn't tell him why they stopped him. They wouldn't tell him what it was all about. Eventually, they handcuffed him, put him in one of the cars, and start asking like where he had just come from and stuff. And he told them, listen, and my son is built like this. Like, he would look intimidating, but his manner is totally, he understands, he's understood his whole life. He got jumped, and my other son got jumped when they were both young teenagers. Both of them had their noses broken, and that was about nothing but race. So they had him in the car. He said, listen, I don't know, because they wouldn't tell him why they pulled him over. He said, I don't know who you're looking for or what they did, but I'm not your guy. And he told him to go in his car and look in the front seat. There was his whole file and the paperwork and the lease he had just signed on a building that I don't remember what it was. It was like $250,000 or something. He said, so I don't know what you think is going on, but I'm not the one. So they went. They saw that that was true. They saw his name on it, and they eventually just left. So he went to the police department the next day, and he talked to the chief of police, and he said, this is what happened. Explain. And the guy kind of, oh, there was something that happened. I forget what it was. Something that happened, and they said that some guy said that whoever, I don't know whether it was supposedly a robbery or something, and it was someone who looked like my son, which translates into the same color as my son, and that when they were driving away from wherever they drove away from, they give the finger to somebody or something. And for that, they put him face down on his lawn with guns drawn on him. And he said he knew that if he made a move, especially because he's so built, if he made a move that scared them, he'd be dead. And he knows that. That's not an exaggeration. He'd be dead because that's happened to people. And now, because of phones and cameras, everybody sees it. Hasn't changed. People are horrified. It's still happening. So I know that since my sons have gotten older and been on the West Coast, they've had experiences like that that they haven't shared with me because they know what it would do to any mother. So it was odd that he shared that with me, but it was right after one of the other shootings. I can't remember which one it was. And
How did you talk about race within your family, with your boys?
We talked about my ex-husband. I was the lightest one in the family. And my ex-husband, you know, we would talk about how they have to be careful, maybe more careful than their white friends, and talked about how to handle themselves to not appear like they're a threat, even though they're clearly not a threat, but to not appear like they're a threat, and how to talk to cops, no matter what the cop behaves like. In that situation, he has all the power. And a lot of them misuse it, and so we had to teach them that at a young age. Because it doesn't matter how old you are. You know, they shot a 12-year-old kid in a park because somehow they felt threatened by him. I mean, it's such nonsense. And so it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what you're doing or not doing. And that's what you always have to tell them. So as a parent, you know, in one sense, you want your kids to feel safe in the world. But on the other hand, you have to tell them these are real dangers. So, yeah. So that's how we talked about it. And it is the hardest thing ever. It was really hard for me when my kids were old enough so that they could be out in the world on their own. Because I had no control. I mean, not that I had a whole lot of control before that. But you can feel like if you're there, you somehow have control. But that was really hard. And that hasn't gotten any easier. So.
How did you learn to have these more open conversations about race?
I don't know, just who I am. And I see, or always saw the danger when people couldn't or didn't. It's necessary. Yeah, I just think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Still not easy. People, you know, there's a lot of organizations that I'm a part of or have been a part of in the past. And the idea of white privilege is still really hard for people to accept that, you know, people get very defensive. It's like, well, I don't have anything to do with that. I don't have anything to do with slavery. I don't have anything to do with any of that. But you still carry a level of privilege that is just as unfair for someone to carry that as it is for the people who don't. But it's the way the world is, unfortunately. Until we can change it, that's the way it is. And the level of inequity that exists, I think, in a lot of countries, but particularly in this country. I mean, this country was built on stolen land by slaves. So it makes it hard to celebrate that in any kind of way. It's only through facing it and having those conversations that anything will ever change. There's a very active group here of Surge. Have you ever heard of them? Surge is an organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice. And it is a national organization that has local groups. And it is all white people who are doing the work of, who are doing this work. And part of that is the philosophy that it is not the job of people of color to educate the white community about any of this. You know, there's enough going on for them to deal with. So it is, there's a very active local group. They're wonderful. They do all kinds of things. But a lot of what is being done and talked about is education around it, is people educating each other. So there's a study group, and they do a lot of reading, and they do a lot of talking. And then there's a lot of actions that they take in the community. One of the philosophies of Surge is that for a local group to exist, part of their responsibility is to be connected to and give support to a local Black-led organization. That doesn't exist in every community, so they have to kind of go outside their community. But it's doing this work not in a vacuum, is having a connection to organizations that are led by people of color. So they've done a really good job here of making those connections. Yeah. In the past year, well, now I'm doing the organizing with the sanctuary movement, but like 2 years ago, what the disabilities that I have made it really hard for me to be able to do a lot of things. So that was real frustrating to have to step back from a lot of things. I was on the board of the social justice group, and I just had to stop, because there's times when I can't walk that well, and so that's gotten in the way of a lot of things that are really important to me. But it's just, this is my reality right now, so it's what I have to deal with. So now I'm more interested, not more interested, but I'm getting interested in issues around accessibility for disabled folks and stuff, and the services for disabled folks, and there's plenty of inequities there as well, so I'll never run out of that kind of work. And actually, when I moved to Hudson, kind of decided I wasn't going to get some, because I've been on the board of a lot of different organizations, and my health had already really started to suffer is when I had to go on disability. And I mean, that didn't happen because of the work that I did. It just made the work I did, I just couldn't do it all anymore. And I had decided I wasn't going to, I didn't know anybody here, so I decided I wasn't going to get involved in any of that. I stayed on the board. Actually, that's where I'm going tonight. There's a feminist organization in Albany that I'm on the board of. And I just didn't back off of that because I just love these people. And I have really good relationships, long-term relationships with a lot of women there. So it's all women of color. And we fund things that, community things that wouldn't normally get funding. So anyway, I'm still a part of that. But I decided I wasn't going to get involved in any of that here. I do mosaics. And I was just going to take care of myself, get as healthy as I could, do mosaics, write, because they do a lot of writing. I've never had the time to do a lot of that. And I don't know what happened. I started meeting people very accidentally. And I got involved with the work here. But it's no matter where I am, I'm going to be drawn to that. I really do have to be careful, because physically there's things that are really difficult. They told me 15 years ago that I had I was probably longer than that. It started with like excruciating pain in my back, and I couldn't sleep at night. I didn't sleep for longer than like an hour. And I didn't know what was going on. And so it took me a long time to go to a doctor. And then it was 6 years of all kinds of tests and stuff, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. But a lot of the tests came back that something was wrong, but they didn't know what. And then a rheumatologist diagnosed me with some weird-sounding autoimmune disorder. And what it had done, they did a bone scan. I have arthritis in every bone in my body. Everywhere where there's bone, there's arthritis. And my spine is growing like this. So you can see when I walk, I'm like starting to be hunched over. I do a lot to try to not let that get worse. But then I started to get shorter. I'm 7 inches shorter than I used to be. And it's like that all landed right here. So my whole body is doing this. And so dealing with a lot of the aspects of that and trying to take care of myself and I go to physical therapy. I was going to yoga. Now I can't get down on the floor because my knee blew up. So it's a lot of physical stuff that's really hard and frustrating. And even though once they saw it written out, they approved me for disability right away, it's been very hard for me to say I'm disabled. I don't want to claim that. I think part of that is because in the work that I did over the years that I did it, I saw so many people who were so attached to that. It's like who they were. It became their identity. And I said, never. I don't care what happens to me. That's a part of my physical reality right now, but that's not who I am. So it was really hard to me to connect to that. And because of that, to even get involved in kind of the disabled community, because there is a whole community of people who are fighting for those rights. Because we live here, and everybody's rights are being screwed up. So I haven't gotten real involved with that, but I can see more and more, people do kind of not see you. And the services that might be helpful aren't there. And even the like doctors and stuff, they just don't know what to do with you. And so they don't offer the kind of help that probably would be the most helpful. It's not the kind of stuff that's covered under medical insurance and stuff. So because of all of that, it's hard for me to do the other work that I've always been committed to. But like I'm cool with that, because there's a lot of really good people out here who are younger and healthier than I am, who are working really hard. So that's good. I mean, I still am a part of a lot of things, but I have had to back off a bit.
What brought you to Hudson?
An accident, kind of. at that time, I really wanted to move from where I was.
Which was Cobleskill?
Yeah, Cobleskill. It was just time for me to get out of there. But I had no idea where I was going. My son, who lives in California, my oldest son's name is Tomas, and he wanted me to move there, but it's like, it didn't feel like, I don't know, I just wasn't feeling it. And my other son had moved to Portland, Oregon, and that's where he lives, my middle son, Chris. And so they kept trying to sell the West Coast to me. My youngest son, Matthew, is in Kingston, so that's right down the river from here. And so it was kind of, I kept telling, could you all just get on the same coast, then I can, because it would be nice to be closer. But anyway, at that time, a friend of mine had a friend, actually it was a guy she was dating, who had grown up in Hudson. He had a house here and he had a business here. He had a contracting business, like doing heating and stuff like that, furnaces, kind of work. And he was getting close to retirement age. He didn't want to be here anymore. But he had a small crew that was still working under his business's name. So he wanted somebody to come here, live in his house so that it wasn't empty, and do like the paperwork with that had to do with the business. He had a house in Florida. He had a house out in Cherry Valley. So he didn't want to be here, but he offered that to me. And it seemed perfect at the time. And I had been to Hudson a bunch of times to go to like music stuff or whatever, and I liked it, and I loved that it was on the river because I really want to be close to water. I'd rather it be the ocean. But this is tidal, so that's a nice feature of it. So I came out and I looked at where he, and actually it was a whole house, and it was just over the border into Greenport, which is only like, you know, it's only a couple of minutes. And I said, yes. I said, however, I'm leaving everything behind. I have nothing here to come back to, nor would I have wanted. But once I make this move, you're not going to all of a sudden say you don't want to do this, right? No, no, no. Never wants to come back to Hudson. So, of course, I moved in January. It was 4 Januarys ago, maybe. But I moved in January. And because when that happened, I only had like a month to clear out, you know, someplace I've been living for a really long time. So I still have stuff in storage that I haven't finished clearing out, just because I had to do the move really quick if I was going to do it. So I moved in January, and in May, he had a new girlfriend who wanted to come check out Hudson. So he said, yeah, I think we're going to come back for a while, and, you know, maybe you could rent a room in the house with us. It's like, no, I'm not doing that. So I decided I wanted to stay in Hudson. I started to get to know people. And I was really lucky. I found a place in subsidized housing down by the river. So I live on the 6th floor. My windows face out to the river and the mountains, and it's a gorgeous view. The building's not so hot, but I can afford it. So
how would you describe the building to someone that's never been in there?
It's the projects. You know, a lot of people have a picture in their head of what the projects are. It is a community on its own that's really a strong community. And so there are a lot of people who have lived in Hudson for pretty much their whole lives who live there. And so there's you can see the strong relationships and community there. The building itself is a, you know, it's government-subsidized housing that was built in the 70s. And if anybody's ever seen one of those buildings, it's exactly what it is. Not particularly attractive. However, I will say that not because of the management, but because of the people who live there, there's usually in buildings like that, there's not a lot of attention paid to the grounds. There's no gardens or anything, but there is, because people there want it. But yeah, it's, I don't know how to describe it.
And how have you been able, what's your relationship like with the rest of the community that lives in the building?
We say hello. I haven't really developed any real strong relationships. Like, there's a few people that I talk to, you know, we talk more than others. Yeah, I don't have real strong relationships. It's just we all talk to each other, but like not stopping by people's houses, stuff like that. I haven't developed those kind of relationships. I leave there all the time. I mean, they see me coming and going, and they're always saying that too, because there is a bunch of people who are outside a lot. There's a good percentage of people in that building who don't have cars. So I was, you know, there's some people who I would take to the store and stuff like that because I knew they didn't have cars. But I'm always leaving. It's not like I'm hanging around the building. So, yeah.
Where are you going when you leave the building?
All over the place. I go to Kingston a lot, to where my son is. I go meet friends. I go to meetings. I go to events. It just seems like I'm always coming and going. They laugh about it. Oh, there she goes again.
In and out.
Yeah. But I don't have any desire to sit downstairs and hang out of the building. It's like, I don't know, maybe I'm too old for that. If I was younger, I probably would. When I lived in a kind of a similar building, only it was much newer at the time. When I left New York City, I was living in a subsidized building. And it was, you know, everything was brand new. And there was a community center downstairs, which there isn't here. And there was, you know, all this nice seating outside and stuff. And, you know, I had little kids. And so we'd be down there with other people and all the kids would be playing together. So that's some of, you know, what happens downstairs. I don't have kids. It just doesn't feel like something that I'm drawn to anymore. I'm just hanging around the building. No. A lot of times I go down to the river. I spend more time down at the river than I would at the building. Hmm. Yeah.
You've mentioned a lot of the organizations you're a part of in Hudson. Mm-hmm. In particular, one that I wanted to clarify the name of. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it was a community organizing organization where this is where the young girls that were saying they don't feel comfortable in Hudson.
That's the social justice organization. And that's what it's called.
Okay.
It was started in the community, and I'm not so much involved with them mm-hmm. right now, but all those organizations are connected to each other. So I'm one of the organizers for the Sanctuary Movement, and that's where any organizing kind of energy I'm putting into this community right now is through the Sanctuary Movement, and that's the name of it, the Sanctuary Movement. So we're working with the issues around immigrants and unfortunately, we've been really busy because there are people who were taken from here. And so the work that we do is trying to hook them up with legal help. Some of them are still in detention. Some of them are in the process of being deported. Some of them we have got them hooked up with legal help where they're out now, but they're not out of danger. They are all... The amount of disinformation that is out in the public around these issues is just staggering. People will say, well, why don't they just get their papers? It's not like that. It's not that simple. It takes years and years and years and a whole lot of money. And there are people we've worked with who've been in the process for over 10 years, who have done everything they were supposed to do, who are not criminals, who are not... If they've been arrested for something, it was overstaying in the country while they were going through the process to get their papers. But they came from places that are dangerous to go back to. And right now what's happening is horrendous all across the country. So the work we're doing with them is trying to help the people who have already been affected, the families, because... our experience here, although we know all kinds of stories from all over the country because we're connected to all these national groups, is that they've taken usually the head of the household, and so they're leaving a family because there's always kids involved. There is the rest of the family who's still here now with no income and very little support. So we work with the family, and every family is different, although there's some similarities. They almost all need the legal help. And we help them with that, help support the family in whatever way we can, provide transportation, trying to help them get the resources they need for their kids and whatever their kids are going through. I mean, these are kids whose, for the most part, fathers are just gone all of a sudden, and some of them saw it happen. You know, they saw, like, there's one family that they were taking the kids to school, and ICE came and basically just plucked them out. So kids have seen that, or they know that all of a sudden their father's gone, and there's no way of answering when or if he's ever going to come back. So families are making horrible decisions, because for a lot of people, they left. Nobody... on a whim, chooses to leave where they live and go somewhere else where they don't know anybody and don't have any resources. They do it because for them, that's pure desperation. And that's happened for so many people. And because there's specific countries, like in different parts of Ecuador and different Latino countries, where what they're escaping is, in so many cases, death in one way or another. And now they're being sent back. After being in this country for like 20, 30 years, they're being sent back. And basically sent back with nothing, just dropped off. So we're trying to do whatever we can to support those families, try to not let that happen. But unfortunately, it's getting worse. They took Westchester County, which is just down the river from us, took a kid on his prom day. So he was a senior in high school. He had come here with his family when he was 11 years old. And he was getting ready to graduate from high school. He was like an honor student. Everybody in the community loved him. He was from a town called, or city, called Ossining down the river. And the day he was going to his prom, they had taken his mother 2 days before, and they came and got him. And no matter what that community has done, and everybody in the community, from the people in the school to the county supervisor, everyone supports him being able to stay. This administration is not happy. That kid never got in trouble. He never got in trouble where he was from. I mean, he was 11 years old when he was brought here. The country is Ecuador, but the area that he came from is just gang violence there. People don't survive. So when somebody gets sent back and they are now American, I mean, he's an American in every way, except for maybe what he looks like and his family history. Now he's being sent back into a country in a situation that he's not equipped at all to deal with. But they don't care. And the information that's being put out about we're only taking the bad ones and the criminal, that's not true. The lies that are coming out of this administration are astonishing. It's just so, because we have a lot of local people who are affected by this, that's the work we're doing. And because I only have the energy to do a certain amount, I have to put the energy where it feels like there's the most need. Not that I'm going to fix this, but I know that I can't not do this kind of work. So that's the organization that I'm doing work with now, more than any of the other ones. And then I'm still connected to it's an organization called Holding Our Own, the group I'm a part of in Albany. So it's like an hour north. You know, and a lot of those people I've been friends with them for a long time. So it's like going to see family.
What's your thoughts about the role you would like to play in Hudson moving forward?
I have no idea. Yeah, I can't answer that really. I want to be part of a community that's really connected to each other, that gives support to each other. I'm not really sure what kind of role I would play in that, just to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And what does how could this community support each other better?
I don't know, by listening to each other. A lot of the people in the community do. There's an organization called Kite's Nest that's amazing. I don't know. I came to the first morning session that was at the library the other day, and I saw a friend of mine who has worked with Kite's Nest all along. Her name is Sarah. And I don't know if Sarah's part of this. She's a young woman.
I think she has helped set up some of the
interviews. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So Sarah works with Kite's Nest. There's people like her who, and I mean, she goes between here and Montreal. I think she's still doing that. There's people like that who they are connected and they are giving each other a lot of support. There's different, there's like a kind of an alternative, I guess that's what people call alternative health community here, that give a lot of support, and they're kind of connected. They all see the work that they're doing as social justice work. And they have a place down by the river. Have you gone down to the river at all?
Yes.
Okay, so there's an amazing building down there, the Basilica, which is an old, huge old brick building that now they have as a venue. And next to it is this little old trailer that they've fixed up. These friends of mine, they're part of two different. One is Wild Gather, and they're businesses, but they're around health and herbalism. This one incredible young woman, Lauren, who has her own business. She's an herbalist, so she grows all kinds of plants and makes them into remedies. And then they're part of this group called Wild Gather. And down at this trailer that they fixed up, they're calling it the Green Trailer, they do all kinds of like community events. Mm-hmm. And that offer, you know, people can do. One of the ones we did was, you know, people make their own oils with all these different ingredients that are all natural and grow in the area. So there are things like that that people are connecting to and supporting each other. So that's happening. I want to see more. I want to connect to more women my age. There are young people here who do incredible things. And not to take anything away from that, but I'd really like to be more connected to people my own age who would have a better understanding of some of the things that I'm going through right now. So there are some women that they don't live in Hudson, they live outside Hudson, that I've connected to through a lot of different things, some of the work with the sanctuary movement, and we're kind of giving each other that support. But I don't know, just in general, people need to listen to each other and reach out to each other, kind of get beyond their own little bubble.
And then just one last question before we wrap up today. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about one thing that you would want someone listening to this, like 20, 50 years from now, to know about Hudson in 2017.
Well, just that, what I just talked about, is some of the people who are here doing very generous work with each other and connecting to each other, that's there is an energy here for that. And I hope it builds, because it has to in order to be sustainable. It would be interesting to me to see Hudson 20 or 50 years from now and see which direction it's going, because quite honestly, it could be a very exclusive community. Mm. If these other things don't keep going and get stronger. Because in some ways that there's part of this community that's going in that way. And all you gotta do is walk Warren Street to see it, you know, and mm-hmm. to hear some of the people who are here. I mean, it's good to be a destination town or city because it brings resources in, but it's like, then how are those resources shared with the community? How does it, or connected to the whole community, not just one very exclusive part of the community. Mm. And so that's what I would hope would continue to happen here. There's some artists who are part of kind of this collective of people working towards social justice and community health. So I hope that's what wins out.
Me too. All yeah. right. We're just going to sit in silence. Mm-hmm. Like 30 seconds.